Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that is the music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we hear a persistent knocking, we open the door, and we find a variety of old franchises and old projects back to be rebooted, restarted, reimagined, and otherwise reheated for a new or maybe for an old audience. And then we'll jump into the question of covers, judging books by them, making decisions based on them, and maybe seeing them on tiny little screens. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I am a blogger and social media producer for Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for Code Switch and Kat Chow's nemesis.
Well, we're always so glad, as sad as we are when Glenn goes on vacation, we're always happy when we get to have Gene and Kat in the studio.
It's always so much fun to be here. Thank you.
It's so fun to have them hating each other.
Yes. This is like what life is like every day for us. Mm-hmm.
So it's like bringing a little brother and sister team into the studio to entertain us. Well, Kat was actually responsible for the impetus behind our first topic, because Kat had mentioned having seen that there was going to be a new anime of Sailor Moon.
Fighting evil by moonlight, winning love by daylight, never running from a real fight. She is the one named Sailor Moon.
Yeah. So Sailor Moon is this Japanese animation that was really popular in 1995 and the early 2000s.
Comes from a well-regarded manga. And
yeah, exactly. And I was listening to a podcast the other day, Sideshow, and there was just a brief mention of the comeback of Sailor Moon. And basically, it's a show where this team of teenage girls, age 14 or so, turn into superheroes, and they basically fight crime together. Now it's back again, and it's going to be on Hulu for a while.
Yeah, it's back again, and then there's a new series that I think they're launching in. I think Hulu has just put up the old ones, and then there are going to be new ones that I think are coming later this summer, and there seems to be some uncertainty about exactly when they will arrive and exactly when the subtitles and then the dub and all that stuff will arrive here.
I believe they're doing it in like 10 different languages. I think that being simultaneously released in a bunch of languages.
Yeah.
In July, I believe.
Yeah.
Like early July.
I think that's right. Kat, did you watch Sailor Moon?
So I did. I watched Sailor Moon probably when I was a little older than I should have been, a little older than their demographic. For once, I feel like I can say that. And what was so interesting and neat and weird about that show for me was that you basically had teen girls who were my age at the time, or mm-hmm. maybe a little bit older.
Animated like you are.
Animated like I am, exactly like me, with like this extravagantly long hair doing stuff and fighting each other. And you had this really, really cheesy dialogue, and yet it was still really captivating.
Hey, Sailor Moon, let's make a deal. You hand over that crystal and I will douse your friends.
No deals with double-crossing bad bleach job nega trash like you. Get ready, the negaverse is dust.
Okay, so you have dialogue
really
like that.
That really speaks to me.
Yeah, yeah, that really spoke to, like, what, 10-year-old Kat?
That's how Kat and I speak to each other. Yeah, that's
it sounds so much like, that's what Super Friends sounded like, too. Mm. You know, the cartoons that I watched when I was a small child many years earlier is, you know, basically the dialogue was very similar.
Yeah. But to kind of unwrap and push more into what Sailor Moon was, I mean, you had all of these female characters on their cast, really, but each of them were so different, even though they were all very feminine. You had Sailors Neptune and Uranus, who were actually partners and lovers, that became more clear that they were together toward the end of the series. And
was that clear, like in the American version, that they were?
I think so. I mean, I remember, I can't remember if it was the American or Japanese version with subtitles that I'd been watching when I noticed that.
Yeah.
That really stood out to me when I was growing up. And mm-hmm. I think that was kind of unique for TV shows.
So were you surprised to hear that they were bringing it back and or doing a new set of them? I mean, did it surprise you at all that it had a sort of place in the current landscape?
Yes, it did, because I had completely forgotten that the show had existed.
Yeah.
But so when Jean and I were talking about this earlier today, Jean brought up the phenomenon of bronies, which are basically the My Little Pony super fans who are pretty unlikely. They're men or teenage boys from age 15 to their 30s or beyond. And they've just started jumping on the My Little Pony bandwagon in what could be ironic, maybe not. So I wonder if the whole Sailor Moon thing is going to be like that, too.
Well, but part of it is that new potential fans of a show like this are being born and raised all the time. I mean, a lot of the fads and brands that we're talking about today are designed for children. And then there's the understanding that kids my age, my kids are 13 and 10, they're not going to have watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They're not going to have watched Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And so even though my kids probably won't watch that, they're just going to watch The Simpsons and Arrested Development again and again, that new kids are coming up all the time, that because of the great melting pot that is YouTube, might have some passing understanding that it has been a cultural phenomenon, maybe, but are largely blank slates onto which these new versions can be written.
But my question, I guess, is, are these things being restarted? And it's a little different with Sailor Moon, which I think is at least recognized as being very influential.
Yeah.
But with some of these things that make this like nostalgia cycle that come back at about the time that people who have a lot of power in the entertainment industry are in their 40s,
yep,
and therefore interested in doing the things that they liked when they were 10. I wonder kind of what the bar is for this whole thing. Like, it's certainly not a 30-year cycle by any stretch of the imagination, but the one that is killing me right now that's about to come back this summer is this Boy Meets World reboot.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Where it's now it's Girl Meets World and it's Cory and Topanga's daughter. And I have to admit, like, I looked at this and I thought, I have nothing against Boy Meets World. It always seemed like a perfectly fine show to me for what it was. But I feel like, is it so hard to make like a family sitcom for Disney? Otherwise, it's like, oh my God, we would never have an idea like that again.
But at the same time, you know, there's a certain amount of, they're probably thinking, where are the kids accessing these? Like, what are the kids' entry points into these shows? This would be a way to access these shows through their parents, where their parents might have an interest that potentially parents and kids could share?
But who wants to watch things your parents want to watch?
Right.
I mean, I know, so,
well, my
so
kids
cool.
watch Arrested Development and The Simpsons and Futurama.
It was so, well, yeah. So
your Steve, kids don't count.
Yeah, Steve's kids don't count. When the Boy Meets World thing was announced, though, there was like this universal squee on Twitter, like, oh my God.
Right.
Oh my God, it's Cory and Topanga. What happened to the...
Right.
Well, universal squee depending on whom you're following.
People, I guess, like in their late 20s, early 30s, like, yeah, depending on who you're following and who, right, how much they like.
It's sort of like my feed, up and died when REM broke up, and I was like, I need to follow a more diverse group of people.
But, you know, it's one of those things that's always funny. Like, the same thing happens with the Ninja Turtles movie that's coming out this summer. It's always like, why? I mean, so Boy Meets World seems at least a little bit more genuine, even though it's obviously like a marketing thing, than like Ninja Turtles, which is delivery mechanism for like products,
for
product,
yeah,
merchandise, right?
Really,
and you
is.
See the Transformers. The Transformers have had like, I feel like 12 iterations now, like as TV shows and now as a million,
yeah,
movies. But they were all like, I mean, those cartoons were basically commercials. They were elaborate commercials for action figures.
Oh, absolutely.
And so Boy Meets World seems a little, I mean, still, you know, just an attempt to be like some brand recognition, like superimposed on this thing that's basically
it probably makes it easier to get it made.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it probably is just, it seems more high concept. Maybe the executives...
High concept.
Like, who... I mean, what was
it's
even the...
Boy Meets World with a girl!
What are those planning meetings like?
Yeah, my mind is blown. The problem is all this stuff. I'm 41 years old, and I'm too old for absolutely everything we're talking about.
Right.
Well, no, but it's that funny thing, and it's when Jean talked about the Twitter response to the thing about Boy Meets World, my reaction to that was, I have never felt more intensely the chasm between me and people who are like, not 20 years
no.
younger than me, but like 10
mm-hmm.
years younger
yeah.
than
mm-hmm.
me. People who have these really strong attachments to, like, I used to sit around and watch Boy Meets World. And I know that I have exactly the same things. I have things like that about shows that were on when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And it's not, they're no better than anyone else's. It's just so weird to me. It's like how I felt when I learned that there was a cult of Newsies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was Newsies, like, Newsies?
Newsies, Hocus Pocus.
And Hocus Pocus is a great one, because Hocus Pocus is another one where if you step into a certain narrowly defined age
I think
range,
it's older than Cat, younger than Jean.
I was like, I'm not sure I get this.
Like, Hocus Pocus, which is this movie with Bette Midler and Sarah Jessica Parker and somebody else. Oh, Kathy and Jimmy. There is this reverence for this movie. It is a big, big deal. And they all, like,
and they're developing a Broadway musical.
Yeah,
of
but
course.
Like, they all know. And then it's not, like I said, it's mine are no better or worse than anyone else's, but you don't realize until you kind of step into them, and then you're like, you guys care about Newsies? Like, right. I remember when I was in probably my late 20s, my mother telling me that the girls in her high school math classes, right, so roughly 10 to 12 years younger than I was, had this fanatical attachment to Newsies.
Yeah.
Which to me was a movie that had like come and gone, mm-hmm. and no one
Yeah, it's like
cared.
Being it's like it was it would be like being obsessed with Cop Rock.
Exactly. And it's not a put down when I say I just had no idea.
Right.
And it's the same thing. Some of these reboots come up and it's like when I first heard about Girl Meets World, I was like, why would you do that? And then, of course, Twitter goes, oh, my God.
Right.
And I say, oh, that's well, why.
Remember what I said about all those bands from 20 years ago mm-hmm. reforming and that we were squinting at the dying embers of our cultural relevance? Because this was the last gasp of these old college bands from 20 years ago. And I think one of the symptoms of that, as far as your age, Linda, and my age, is now the ones that are coming back that people are excited about mean nothing to us. We are old. We are over.
It's true.
I mean, to the point about proprietary, like, age kind of territorialness, when the Gem thing was announced and they were
I was going to say something about Gem.
People were like excited, and then people felt like, oh my gosh, they're going to make the Misfits older than the Holograms. This is not keeping with the spirit.
This is not canon.
It's like, how we're talking about a bunch of dolls that were made into a cartoon, right? There's no like sacred text here. Like, we cannot molest.
This is not the framers' intent.
Absolutely right.
It's true, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, people want to see their thing come back, but at the same time, they both live in fear and live in delicious anticipation of yep. how much it's going to be ruined.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
I can't wait to be disappointed in this.
It's like, it's going to be so much fun to hate this. It's like the idealistic love of things of your youth becomes this cynical, rhythmic cycle of disappointment.
Has there anything ever been like kind of repurposed that you guys loved in this,
yeah,
in this kind of reorientation?
Yeah, much, much better.
Boy, that's an interesting question. No. I mean, I think about like when I was a kid, I watched a lot of syndicated George of the Jungle cartoons, mm-hmm. which are fantastic. They're these Jay Ward cartoons, like, you know, the guy who did Rocky and Bullwinkle mm-hmm. and Dudley Do-Right and all that stuff. George of the Jungle was a very short-lived animated cartoon that I loved, even though it was from well before my time. Mm-hmm. Then they made the stupid Brendan Fraser movies that were really dumb. And yeah, I had that same like, oh boy, there's going to be, oh, it's terrible.
But then it's kind of fun that it's terrible. Like, you wouldn't yeah. really want it to be great.
And because these terrible movies came out and were successful, that means they put the cartoons on DVD at long last, yeah. so I could replace my bootlegs, which I had.
Yeah, bootlegs.
George of the Jungle bootlegs. But it's almost like hating the reboot of something. Mm-hmm. The cycle's a little short on Sailor Moon and a little short on Boy
But the cycles
World.
Of all this stuff is getting, nostalgia cycles are getting smaller mm-hmm. and smaller
right.
anyway.
But it's like the cycle works in your favor if you hate the new thing. Then it kind of reinforces that feeling that you have that everything used to be better.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's just ruining everything. Which, of course, people have believed for,
well, time and more.
And my daughter is 10, and she's already really disappointed in the new season of Arrested Development.
Right.
Like, it's terrible.
Wow. Well, and it gives you that sense that you have taste. Because it's mm-hmm. like, I'm so discerning that I don't like this as much. And sometimes that's valid. Sometimes it's because the remake is unnecessary and has no inspiration behind it. And sometimes it's just because you love the old thing and you're never going to like the new thing as much as the old thing because it's not right to you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, if they brought back, you know, we're going to do a new Moonlighting, I'd be like, I hate you.
forever. Oh, that's a great example.
Like you the would Sports be Night reunion movie, yeah. I would be the person who'd be like, I hate this.
But it's interesting. I was jotting down possibilities and examples and everything, and it's really interesting, like things that never went away. That, you know, their fame ebbed and then they rushed back. I mean, Pokemon mm-hmm. being the perfect example. One of the first things that I brought up when we were having this conversation is that Pokemon was gigantic in the 1990s mm-hmm. and then went away and then came roaring back to the point where it is the obsession of my kids and many, many of the people that they know and hang out with. And I was talking to my son about this, you know, and he's 13, and he was saying there are two gigantic pockets of Pokemon fans. Mm-hmm. There are kids like his age and his sister's age, and then there are people in their 20s who played Pokemon as kids. And I offered him the theory that what happened is all of these Pokemon collectors discovered romance in their teens. And then as they got through their into their 20s, they gave up.
Yes. And they returned to the trading card.
They circled back.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. As someone who, I mean, when I was in, I don't know, middle school, probably not high school. I don't think it was high school. Maybe elementary school and middle school. Let's rewind so I seem cooler. I remember having those Pokemon trading cards, having no idea what they were, but also occasionally playing with them, kind of in that, I don't know, Magic the Gathering style. I still don't know what was going on. And then also having the Pokemon game on my N64 and Game Boy Advance or whatever it was. But there are some people who I'm friends with on Facebook from my high school, and I see Pokemon stuff come up in my newsfeed, and I'm like, who are you guys? What are you doing?
But this is, again, the brony thing. Like, there are people who just really revel in something that feels kind of offbeat to them, even if it's generationally offbeat.
And, oh, one thing that I do want to say is, so the My Little Pony spinoff is called My Little Pony Equestria Girls, which Gene and I were laughing at the name because it sounds... It kind of sounds... Doesn't it sound sort of like a birth control pill? Am I allowed to say that?
Am I allowed to say
birth control pills, dirty, filthy, filthy word.
Gene was like, why are you
seven dirty words
afraid?
Plus birth control pills.
No, but I mean, there was just something about it. So in that spinoff series, Equestria Girls...
It does
girls,
sound like a birth control. Yeah, like Equestria. Based on horse hormones. Watch a little Equestria Girls. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Tell us why you love Sailor Moon. Tell us why you love Pokemon. Tell me why I'm wrong not to want a Sports Night reunion movie. And, you know, we are always happy to hear what you have to say. Now, our other topic today, we were going to talk about covers, not song covers, but covers. And one of the reasons why I brought this up, and this was a topic that I suggested, was that I am getting ready to go to, and when you hear this episode, I will be at Book Expo in New York, where they just cover walls and walls and shelves and show floor with books. Even just the photos of the exhibit hall, I look at and I think, how are you supposed to make any sense out of what you might want to pay attention to?
Yeah.
Because you wind up looking at this sea of book covers. And this is a place where you suddenly find yourself confronted with an ocean of physical books, where you are looking at physical book covers, which made me remember that very often in my own reading, I don't look at physical book covers.
Oh, right, because you're a Kindle person.
Right. So I was, well, and I maybe see it once when I pick it out. But then I don't see it again, like, every time I pick up the book or open the book, because it goes straight to the page I was reading. So I was thinking about
the covers are just red shoes.
Yeah. Nice.
Legs.
So, yeah. Just a leg and shoe. So I was thinking about book covers and also album covers and trying to think about what purpose those things still serve and whether or not they have changed. And I will come back around to my theory of this. But, Stephen, one of the things I asked you earlier is, like, I know there were album covers, and now there are CD covers, but my little obscure question was, did we go through any sort of age of, like, cassette art?
It's all the cassette art was repurposed album covers.
Just and little so, tiny.
And really, depending on how elaborate they wanted to be in making cassette art, they could either repurpose it so that the J card would fold out and look mm-hmm. like album cover art, or the really cheapy ones would have a square of the LP cover shrunk down slightly larger than postage stamp size.
Right.
And then there'd just be a bar of blue or black or yeah. whatever. Cassettes, not my favorite medium,
yeah.
were never really...
We'll link to Stephen's Haterade essay on cassettes.
Yes. Oh, cassettes are the worst. No. So the answer to your question is generally, I'm sure there are exceptions, especially with independently released cassettes where they might have used that particular shape to their design advantage. But for the most part, cassettes are kind of this interstitial medium, kind of your gateway from LPs to CDs. And yeah, CD art in general, I mean, it's really interesting. When we do our best albums of the year, and we're actually putting together best albums of the first half of 2014 right now, is often the first time I see a lot of very prominent album artwork. I mean, I was in a record store recently around the time of Record Store Day and really poring over, like, oh, that's what that album looks like. Mm-hmm. Oh, that St. Vincent art is weird. You know, I very often get these things as MP3s. I often get promos, and so I'm not necessarily...
It doesn't come with the cover.
It doesn't come with digital art attached. When it does come with digital art attached, it is teeny, teeny, tiny on your screen. And I think it's harder and harder for cover art to stand out in any big way. And I think if you polled people about their favorite records and said, what does the cover look like? They wouldn't necessarily know.
They might not even remember. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the ones of our youth.
When things were better.
Those great, like how Journey always had the album covers that were like, it's a spaceship. It's a video game. It's a pinball machine. And now everything is ruined. Gene, do you look at a lot of book covers and stuff like that?
I do, actually, only because my bookshelf friend helped me design my apartment, and so her in her house, all her books were aligned chromatically. Like, I mean, all the...
Wait, by color?
Yeah, so she had all her books. All the red books were in one place and all the...
And then is it organized by height, too?
No. I mean, it actually kind of works out pretty serendipitously. They all just randomly, like, kind of work in terms of height. But they're all by color, right? So if you look at her bookshelves...
She segregates her bookshelves
yes,
by
exactly.
color.
Yes, exactly.
Just thinking that.
I thought we were past this. but... one of the things is, I mean, and it was funny, was just listening to you guys talk, is that I actually don't know what the covers of those books look like. I mean, I usually...
You know the spine.
I know the spine looks like, right? I know, you know, The Warmth of the Suns is like a brownish color, right? If it was organized some other way, I'd be like, I would never alphabetize my books because that's crazy. But hey. If it was organized some other way, it would be harder for me to find. But I actually don't remember what those book covers look like. I just know, like, I have a vague sense of the color scheme. But, I mean, I think it's interesting what you guys are saying about albums because they're kind of collecting a bunch of audio, right? And now so much of our interaction with these things are like as piecemeal, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't need necessarily, well, there's no cover for like, you know, some random Kanye West song, right? You know,
right.
A lot of stuff is like being beamed into our lives, like in a very kind of...
Well, and that you mentioned that Kanye West, I mean, Yeezus in particular, mm-hmm. is a very strangely packaged
CD
record.
Cover.
When I saw it for the first time, like 6 months after it came out, I'm like, where's the art?
Right.
I think, what does some recent cover art look like? Sometimes, like, the things that jump out are just very, very extreme. Mm-hmm. Like, in order to stand out now with cover art, there's a group called Death Grips, and their last album is called No Love Deep Web, and the cover art... How do I describe this on a family podcast? is the title is scrawled on a man's genitals.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And then shot as a selfie.
Okay.
Down. And it's
sure.
it's kind of appalling, mm-hmm. but it stands out.
But you remember it.
I remember it. It's like the only cover art I remember from mm-hmm. last year.
See, Stephen just explained that album cover. That's much worse than birth control. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because when I got thinking about this, my first thought when I thought about book covers was, it's so much more common for the only time you see the book cover to be like the little tiny image when you buy it on Amazon. And that instead of shopping in a bookstore or, you know, at Book Expo, where you're walking past real physical book covers, you're looking at these tiny little images. So I was thinking, you know, they must be really minimalist. And there are certain ones where I think that's true, including some very popular ones, like the Twilight books.
Oh,
these
yeah.
very, the ones before the movies have these very, very simple stylized covers where it's just like the hand and the apple.
Oh, yeah. Those are so iconic.
Right. Wow. But at the same time, I went back and I was looking at a lot of old, like, classic book covers. And honestly, they've always been kind of simple. And I started to think, well, you know, they were always intended to be seen from a distance, either like when somebody was reading it on a bus and you saw them. They've always had to stand out in a sea of them on a shelf in a bookstore or something like that. So I think they've always been kind of had basic graphic elements as opposed to like intricate art. You can kind of sometimes look at books and be like, yes, you know, a lot of thought went into making sure that this book cover from a distance would look very different from other book covers. I was looking at the cover of Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, which has this kind of like angular thing where the words are going at a particular angle and there's a bird on the other side and the color scheme is kind of distinctive. And you would never, when seeing that cover, confuse it with any other book. So it is interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
On the other side of that, Quartz actually had an essay maybe like 2 weeks ago about all these books that are set in Africa.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that was so funny.
The silhouette of the acacia tree and like the sunset in the background.
It's always an acacia tree.
It's always an acacia tree.
Including about when it's about countries that don't have acacia trees.
Absolutely right. just that one big tree. Africa, right.
Yeah, the section of your bookshelf that is full of books about Africa is in the orange
section. In the sunset section.
The sunset section.
I will say that, I mean, when thinking about this, I for some reason thought about all those romance novels, the Harlequin-ish romance novels, where you have a Fabio-esque shirtless man kind of holding up a woman. But one question that I had was, at what point did, for example, the folks behind 50 Shades of Grey, who came out with a cover, decide to not have something as overtly romancy?
I think that romance has had its own battle with that imagery.
Yeah.
For one thing, I think a lot of people who read romance have found the discussions around that really reductive. That's where the very silly phrase bodice ripper comes from, even though almost no books actually have anything that looks remotely like that. I mean, first of all, romance is really varied. And if you look at historical romances and stuff like that, you'll still see those kinds of covers, like, the, you know, the voluminous dresses and all that. But I think that things like 50 Shades of Grey, they're going for a different kind of style. I mean, that comes out of not just like the erotica part of romance, but also the contemporary part. And contemporary romance novels tend to look a lot more like other popular fiction. So you get, you know, this is one of the things I thought about when I was thinking about book covers is there's a lot of talk about cliches, like the cliches of book covers, like the books about women, you know, who have jobs and boyfriends, which always have like a shoe and all that stuff. And to some degree, those are problematic and reductive and all that. But it's also kind of a form of coding where look at the cover and you kind of know what kind of book it is. One of the authors that I was thinking about, who I talk about a lot on this podcast, is Rainbow Rowell, who wrote Eleanor and Park, which is, you know, brilliantly reviewed in the New York Times and all that, and is a very, very beloved YA book. But prior to that, Rainbow wrote a book called Attachments, which is essentially a romance, but it has, like all of her writing, it has kind of undertones of seriousness and melancholy and kind of people hurting. And I thought about the fact that Attachments, which is set in an office and involves two women who are friends who write emails to each other, and the guy who is charged with looking at your email to see if you're violating the filters and stuff like that. And that book easily could have had a cover that was like, you know, a photograph of a woman with her feet up on a desk, you know, like with her high-heeled feet up on a desk. And you could have made that the cover. And I think that she would have had a different career if that had been the cover, because it could have been the same book pitched in the same way. But instead, you know, Attachments has, all of her books have these sort of drawing-based covers where they're very thematic. And in Eleanor and Park, one of the Eleanor and Park covers, there are a couple of them, but in one of them, it has the two kids sitting next to each other with their headphones, listening to a joined pair of headphones. And it's really a very, very lovely thing. She has a new book, Landline, that has an image of a kind of an old-timey phone handset. And Attachments, there are two office chairs on the cover in this little drawing. And we'll put links to all these covers for you to look at. But there are two little office chairs. And then there's just these two little paper clips in this really, really simple drawing. And it made it seem like a fiction book and not a silly fiction book, which is how you sometimes feel like they're encouraging you to see books when they're like, look, shopping bags. And many of them that are marketed that way, it's not the writer's fault. It may be a very serious and interesting book. But I think it tends to take away from the image that what you're doing is real writing when it's marketed in a way that kind of codes it to be frivolous. Mm-hmm. So I think it's always interesting to kind of see the choices that they make.
Well, and the frivolity in that coding really is often meant to encourage impulse purchases. I want to read a book that evokes what other books that look like this are about. And so it's a tricky calculus, to be sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as a writer, I think it would drive me bonkers to just turn a book I spent, you know, 2 years writing over to some design department at my publishing company, and it comes back with a stock photo. I mean, there's like a BuzzFeed list that Linda was sending around of like identical book covers.
Yeah. Where clearly they're using literally the same photo on all these different covers.
Yeah, and when I edited a book 10, 12 years ago, I was with The Onion, and we designed it in-house, and I like watched the whole process like a hawk because I wanted my book to look exactly the way I wanted it. And it does look exactly the way I wanted it, with tons and tons of white space. Mm-hmm. And sort of the title in logo form. Like, uh-huh. I really took to heart the fact that you can spot my book from, you know, 100 yards away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once again, you should come and chat with us. And I do want to say, we will also link to, there's a wonderful TED Talk by Chip Kidd, who designs a bunch of book covers.
You'll know his art when you see it.
Yeah, and did like the cover art for Jurassic Park and a bunch of other books that you will sort of recognize. He's very funny, and he talks about the philosophy behind his designing of book art. So we'll link to that too. And you should tell us which ones you like and you know, what you look for in a book cover, because that's how you judge a book, by the cover.
Yeah, that's right.
That's how we do it. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I'm not going to pretend that this is anything other than blatant toadying self-promotion. Just in the last few days, as we're taping this, NPR Music has launched a special channel on the Roku that is specifically for Tiny Desk Concerts. Now, I guess this is presumably some sort of business partnership with Roku, so I feel like a terrible, terrible shill when I say I love my Roku. Mm-hmm. I would be talking about how much I love my Roku even if we didn't have some sort of partnership with them. It's a little box that lets you stream the internet on your TV. For those who don't know, I highly recommend it. And now there's a whole a channel that is nothing but Tiny Desk Concerts.
That is so dope.
It doesn't have every single one of them, because not every single one of them was licensed for this sort of purpose, but there are, I've been told, nearly 300 of the something like 360 that we've recorded. It's just a chance to, on your big old TV, sit and live or relive more than 70 hours of the recordings that we have made in our little office. And as the person who, with Bob Boylan, created that series, I gotta say, it feels pretty cool.
It should. That's
really dope, man.
That's awesome. to watch my little ticket to immortality on my big old TV. Tiny Desk Concerts on the Roku.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
I am very excited about mine. So one of my favorite bloggers, Phil Yu from Angry Asian Man, posted this thing about chopsticks he saw that were for sale from the Brooks Brothers. And these chopsticks cost $245 for a single pair.
Wow.
One pair. Two sticks.
Are they made from the true cross?
I'm not sure, but they come with... they don't actually come with chopstick rests, but you can buy chopstick rests separately.
They're $250 and they don't come with chopstick rests.
No, $105 on sale. They used to be $150, this chopstick rest. But I finally clicked on the link after seeing it for a week or so. And my favorite part are the reviews. So there are maybe like 10 reviews, some from more recent days. I think people getting snarky on the internet. But 11 months ago, someone asked, can I put these in the dishwasher? And the response from Brooks Brothers is pretty funny. So they say, we advise against putting these in the dishwasher as they're handcrafted of Tillis Japonica wood and treated with a sap of a Japanese lacquer tree, both of which are rare and very precious materials.
It's like, why would you need to put, like, you
who'd put wooden chopsticks?
I know.
Yeah,
why would you? It takes like 2 seconds to clean.
You just really wipe them.
Yeah.
With
water and a sponge. So. So that was what was making me happy.
Water and a Sponge by Kat Chow. All right. Thank you, Kat Chow. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
Stephen will appreciate this because, well, we are like some of the few, I guess, avowed sports fans in the building. Uh-huh. We talk about football like in the elevator banks, quietly in hushed tones. But what's making me happy actually is the NBA playoffs. And specifically, we are at a point where we are starting to see LeBron James kind of enter into the great pantheon of
basketball yes.
players.
Now, side note, Gene Demby, Miami Heat fan.
I'm a Miami Heat fan. But mostly I'm a LeBron James fan. I mean, he is a virtuoso, right? I mean, he's this, like, he's not even like a basketball player so much, he's like a video game boss, right? Like, he just is... he does so much really well. It's almost unfair. I think if you like sports, if you like the kind of unpredictability of sports, which you guys were talking about not long ago, it is fascinating to watch someone kind of bend the rules of sports all the time. There was this point in which everyone assumed that Michael Jordan was just, there was no argument, right? He was the greatest player ever.
Right.
And now LeBron James is 29 years old. He is basically chomping away at all the record books. He is... without question, the best player on the planet.
And this is a story that's been unfolding for 15 years.
Right, I mean, exactly.
People have known about this guy since he was a kid.
He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he was like a sophomore in high school or something.
Yeah.
And he's the next big star. And watching him kind of
become an actual
this guy,
big star.
Right? Now he is like actualized, right? It is like a fascinating, we're just at a very fascinating moment. And maybe he has 4 or 5 years of like great basketball left in him. But this is the peak of his career, right? This moment right now. I've been watching the playoffs. You start to take it for granted. It that someone is this good, but it is really, really, really rare for someone to be this good. And you know, Kevin Durant is not too far behind,
right,
he's a little bit younger. But if you are a sports fan, it's like watching Federer at the top of his game, right? You're like, you're watching someone do this thing at a level in which it's never been done.
Thank you, Gene Demby.
Thank you.
So, I have a few little things making me happy this week. Got another chance this weekend to watch my younger nephew play baseball, and my older nephew drove me in a car. He has his permit now. It was fine. He's a very safe driver. My safety and my intact nature after driving with my 15-year-old nephew is definitely making me happy this week. I watched, not exactly in honor of swearing, but in celebration of swearing, perhaps. I watched an entire season of Hell's Kitchen over the weekend.
Nice.
Just because. Just to do it. Just because I like yelling. And this is a little bit spoilery about the very end of the Mad Men half season that just ended. But if you don't want to know a little bit about what happened at the very end of that, you should.
Gene is plugging his ears.
It's going to not be very spoilery.
Okay.
It's going to be non-plot spoilery, just format spoilery.
There's no plot in Mad Men.
Surprisingly enough, the half season of Mad Men ended with a musical number. And it ended
what?
With a musical number performed by Robert Morse, who plays Bert Cooper on the show and who long ago was a Broadway song and dance man. And he's in the film of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which is appropriate to the show. So they managed to end the season with a little bit of, as Mad Men will kind of go into little dream things occasionally, they managed to fit in a dream sequence involving Robert Morse.
The sunbeams that shine, they're yours, they're mine, and love can come to everyone. The best things in life are free.
And then, of course, making me happy, as it was making me happy last week, we are having a live show on June 24th. And as this comes out, you are only days away from tickets going on sale. They will go on sale at noon on June 2nd.
Eastern time.
And that is at pchh200.bpt. That's B as in boy, P as in PCHH, T as in tickets, .me. M-E spells me. pchh200.bpt.me. And that is where you will get your tickets beginning on June 2nd at noon Eastern Time for the show on the 24th here at NPR HQ. We will undoubtedly have some special guests. We got hit up this weekend by our friend Audie Cornish, who I think we're probably going to wind up shoving into the door, whether she wants us to or not. Probably our friends Jean and Kat we will invite to be at our live show. It's always so
wonderful. This is the first they're hearing of it.
I'll be in Alaska.
This is the first they're hearing of it. So we hope that you will take a moment and see how your calendar is looking. And if you would like to come and join us on the 24th, we will be having, as I said, a live show, pchh200.bpt.me on June 2nd, noon. You'll be helping us. All right. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEED215. You can follow our
our producer, Lauren Migaki at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I, and our also producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. And as always, you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is always good to see Eugene and Kat, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.